Today's Dead Idea, this is part 4 of our series on the steam technology of the ancient world, and last time, we traveled all the way back to the Hellenistic period to find out what was up with this amazingly innovative period that you almost never get to hear about, but which laid the scientific foundations for nearly everything that we've been exploring in this series. We visited Pergamum and Rhodes, and finally arrived in the port of Alexandria. Now, today, it's time for us to conclude our roleplay with an exploration of the Great Library of Alexandria. That's what we're talking about today on Dead Ideas. Hey, thanks for listening, everybody. The music we just heard was composed by Rachel Westhoff, my lovely wife, who said to me last night, "Put on this wig and these glasses, Brandon. Let's play Sexy Librarian. I'll let you punch my library card."
Nerd love, everybody.
Yes. I believe we have 2 shots to take due to our gish.
Our gish, Andre. Yes. Yep. That sounds right.
Because I said Dead Idea twice
sounds like
in
3.
The introduction. Oh, okay, 3 shots. All right, ready?
To Living Ideas.
To Living Ideas.
All right, to Living Ideas.
Yep.
Wow, okay, yep. Okay. And ladies and gentlemen, we are, in fact, taking these shots.
This is going to be an interesting episode.
Living Ideas.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Let's be careful after
definitely
that.
Definitely history in the making.
Okay.
So this is the 101st.
This is the 101st
episode of this podcast that I won't name right now. Because I want to stay reasonably sober.
This is all bonus, folks. We're living on borrowed time.
Yeah.
We promised 100 episodes, but we're going past it because we're going to do the series right.
Yeah.
All right? So we're going to continue on until we're done. Got today. Next, we'll have an interview with Jordan Harbour that will conclude this series.
Cool.
Yep. Jordan Harbour of the Twilight Histories.
Amazing.
Okay.
Well, and then there will be the History of History podcast after that, right?
There will be more stuff coming out.
That's, so that's not the final episode.
But
not
as
quite.
Far as our format, as we've usually done it, and doing all the series of Dead Ideas and stuff, it's concluding with this series. But there will be occasional news and updates.
Kind of sad.
Very infrequent Dead Ideas.
Oh,
shit.
You're killing us, man.
All right, here we go.
All right. To Living Ideas. Avery, I hope that you're laughing as you listen to this.
Yeah.
So there will be more things that are just not the normal format.
If this episode goes off the rails, it's all Avery's fault.
It is. Or maybe the fault of our souls.
Yes. Yeah. So everybody keep your subscription settings and everything else. Just keep them the way they are. That's the best way to get any new content that comes out during the time period between the end of this series, and the beginning of the new one on the history of sex.
I just have to say that it is a little sad to me that it's coming to a close. I've loved this entire podcast, every series you've done. The ones I haven't been on, I'm a listener, so yeah, I'm going to miss it.
Thank you, Andre. It's sad to me too, but it's time.
And you've got another podcast coming down the line.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I'm excited for it. Okay, so Andre...
Yes.
By the way, we have an episode to do here.
Yeah, that's right. It's easy to forget with all the booze flowing around here.
Exactly.
Yes.
Did you know that the Great Library of Alexandria was not really a library in the sense that we think of one today where you can go and borrow books from it?
It sounds more like an impound lot for confiscated books based on my experience last time.
Yes. It was really more like a dragon's hoard, to be honest.
Okay.
It was not open to the public, and it did not loan out books. Nobody's library cards got punched. However, it was the largest collection of books in the known world.
Right. I think that was typical of libraries until fairly recently. It was really just a place to keep books, and those privileged few who could access them, that was great.
Yes. Yeah. The Library of Alexandria began with the first Hellenistic ruler of Egypt, Ptolemy I, who heeded his advisor's advice to acquire books on rulership. So he started collecting those. Then he thought, well, maybe I should learn about the cultures of people that I'm ruling.
Oh.
So he started collecting those.
Surprisingly
and finally,
forward thinking.
Yeah, and then the project finally exploded to include all knowledge in the Greek-speaking world. And even beyond that, in fact, because they would get books from non-Greek languages and translate them into Greek. And fact, the translators, they were called scribblers. The Greek word is karakitai, and it means scribbler.
Okay.
The translators were the most common type of scholar at the Library of Alexandria. So books were acquired in a number of ways, both by purchase and by trickery.
This, by the way, is probably why it's not accessible to the public, because these are pretty valuable.
Yeah. For example, Alexandria arranged to borrow Athens's collection of plays by Aeschylus, Sophocles, and Euripides, all these playwrights, which Athens only agreed to on condition of a hefty deposit of 15 talents, which equals 1,000 pounds of precious metal.
Wow, okay.
It's like 450 grams.
Wow.
After copying the works, though, Alexandria returned the copies to Athens and kept the originals and said, you can keep our money.
Wow.
We're going to keep the originals. They're ours now.
Wow. So let them keep the money. Why even give the copies back? Jeez.
I guess they felt guilty. I don't know.
Right.
So the collection further swelled as a result of incoming ships, as we saw last time.
Right.
All ships entering port were searched, and the books found were confiscated and copied, with the originals staying in the library and the copies going back to the owners if you were lucky.
Right. So, I mean, that actually is the most impressive thing to me in a lot of ways, was that this library was not just its ongoing affair. It was such a priority of the government that they would use, like, customs and military power. Like, they'd actually spend personnel to just, like, we got to sweep every ship for books and enforce this.
It was a state operation.
Yeah.
In just the same way that when you look at, like, America's budget and, like, 75% of it or whatever is military budget.
Right,
whatever.
Right.
And there's like this little bit for healthcare.
Right.
Comparatively little.
Yeah.
In just the same way, they're like, all this is for education. Yeah. Because nobody else had done that before.
Right.
They were like, this is our one thing, you know?
Yeah. Well, sounds like they had a good naval budget too.
They did have a good naval. 40%
of the budget, Navy, 40% library, 20% probably statues of the king.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the result of all this was a massive dragon's hoard of books like none other. And this attracted the best and the brightest from all over the known world. And you really had to be the best and the brightest to get your hands on this collection, because not just anyone could stroll into the library. You had to be invited. Those who were invited enjoyed special privileges.
Hmm.
So, Andre, your character, Pyrrho,
yeah,
from Pergamum,
right,
the parchment maker's son, the genius of Pergamum,
yep,
you will enjoy these same privileges.
Great.
That included a hefty salary, free room and board in the royal quarter of the city.
Wow, okay.
Which is where the library was located.
Sure,
we don't know
yeah.
exactly where it was, but somewhere in there. And also exemption from taxation.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which is kind of big.
Yeah.
Scholars, however, lived in tension with the local population, because coming from all over the known world, they were usually foreigners.
Hmm.
So it's, you know, the dynamic you had with, like, Albert Einstein or Nikolai Tesla working in America,
sure,
right?
Yeah.
Einstein was German, Tesla was Serbian, I believe it was.
I don't know.
Yeah. So anyway, you were foreigners in Alexandria, and you were perceived that way. And locals didn't necessarily take kindly to foreigners being granted all these special privileges that they themselves didn't even get,
right,
you know?
Yeah.
Nevertheless, the promise of the library was worth it, both for the scholars and for Egypt. It was the world's greatest concentration of minds. Basically, they had a gigantic think tank.
And not one of them ever thought of coming up with a backup library. You know?
Well,
why don't we just give these copies back to Athens? No, put them in a separate library in a different walled city.
Well, they didn't do it in a different city, but they did have overflow libraries.
Oh, okay. Cool.
Yeah, so there ended up being so many books in the Library of Alexandria that they had to have a daughter library in the Serapeum, which was the temple to Serapis.
Okay.
The Great Library was actually part of the Museion, which was the temple of the Muses.
Wow, yeah. That seems fitting.
Yeah, the Museion. If you translate it literally into English, it would be museum.
Right, yeah.
That's what it would be. So they had a daughter library in the Serapeum. And also, as things got rolling here, other people in other parts of the Mediterranean started to see, like, hey, this is kind of a good idea. Maybe we should do the same thing.
Mm.
So, for example, Pergamum.
Right.
Yeah.
Trying to get in the library.
These other library things started perking up. So it was really the collection of all these brilliant minds into one giant think tank that made this project so special.
Hmm.
Even more so than the books, I would say. The books are pretty damn special.
Right.
But it's really everybody coming together, cross-fertilizing their ideas, living together. They even had like a place where they could dine together. It's crazy.
Yeah.
Wow. That's the engine that drove the explosion of Hellenistic science in the 3rd century BCE. So, Andre, this is where your character is now headed. You've just arrived at the docks in Alexandria, and you're not just here for research. You're also here for a secret mission.
Yes.
Right? As we heard last time, Eumenes, the heir to the throne of your city, has tasked you with infiltrating the library and stealing the plans for the floating statue.
The hover goddess.
Exactly. And remember that you are to seek out the head librarian, specifically, yes. Eratosthenes, who, if anyone, will be the one who guards that secret.
Yeah, I'll recognize him because he'll be flying around in a hover statue. I'm assuming it's like mecha armor from an anime.
Now, it's going to take all of your wits and wiles to pull this off today. So are you ready?
I'm almost ready,
uh-huh.
But I think this time Piero is going to remember to start off by making some oblations to Taiki for making this voyage safely.
You know, you could sacrifice to the local god Serapis that you have heard was invented wholesale in this period.
I would have heard that?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
During the reign of Ptolemy the First, they just made up a new god. And they called him Serapis.
Wow.
Yeah. He was a combination of the Apis bull, which is Egyptian, and Pluto? I forget which Greek figure that they combined. But they combined them into this god Serapis, made a new statue as the holy statue.
See, theologically, I can see, like, the if you were a believer, like, the argument that that's not making up a new god. It's, like, recognizing an aspect of these two gods that is in common or a new face of them. Or
and that's part of how they sold it.
Right, yeah.
Because the Egyptians had long since taken their gods they had always had and, like, hyphenated their names. You had, like, Ray Ammon.
Right, yeah.
And, you know, then they're like, ooh, what would that god be like?
Right.
So they kind of saw it as legit.
Yeah.
But it was also a conscious effort to take a population that was divided into two cultures, Greek and Egyptian.
Oh, yeah, right.
And reflect them both in one single state cult.
Yep.
So that you could control everybody at once.
That's great. So part of the library is in the Temple of Serapis, though.
Yeah, the daughter library, the overflow.
I think when I get there, I'll think about making some offerings to him. But for now, I'm holding on to the Egyptian gods, but I will offer it to Taiki and Poseidon, actually, would make sense.
That would make sense. Right. Yes, very good. So you disembark your cargo vessel, step out onto the docks. You find a good place, probably right there for Poseidon is where you would do your oblations. Right. You do the other oblations as well. Somehow now you've always known that your destiny would one day lead you here to this place. And now here you are in Alexandria. This is the largest city in the known world at this time. Now, estimates for the population of Alexandria at this time range from 300,000 to 600,000 people.
That's nothing to sneeze at.
The only cities larger at the time in the world, as far as I could uncover, are possibly Pataliputra in India and Chang'an in China.
Great.
Chang'an was the capital at the time.
And I probably would know very little about...
No, you wouldn't know either.
Probably wouldn't have even heard of them.
I doubt it.
I mean, Alexander got into India, but not that far.
Yes. You might have actually heard of Pataliputra because... Okay. As we heard, the Ptolemies were actually sending ships over to India. So actually, you might have heard that
one. Might have heard of that one.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. But in any case, it is a big fucking city.
Yeah. And I bet being from Bergamum, which I would have thought of as a good-sized, respectable city, I'm probably a little blown away.
Yeah.
And probably largely by the smell and, you know, how crowded everything is.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
So you pass into the city.
Mm-hmm.
You get the smell.
Yep.
But you also are impressed by many other things. You find that the streets of Alexandria, for example, are nothing like home.
Hmm.
With all those hairpin turns and twisting streets, you know, in your city.
Sure.
And also, you know how just like all those old cities are just like, you've got all these tiny alleyways and things because the city's grown up organically. So everything's tiny and narrow and, you know, twisting. This is nothing like that.
Huh.
Nothing like that. Because this was a city that was consciously founded and designed.
Wow.
Yeah, it was founded by Alexander himself when he came through Egypt. And you see that the city is laid out like a grid.
Yeah.
So you've got all straight streets, you know, and it's as if an abstract plane of geometry had like superimposed itself onto the landscape itself. And then that was your city. This is a designed city.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm like, this is a city that scholars and wisdom built.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The people in the streets of Alexandria are all different colors, the skin tones ranging from fair to deepest midnight.
Hmm.
You may never have seen anyone like that
before. Probably not, yeah.
Before. This is indeed a cosmopolitan city. Even more arresting to you, though, is the sheer number of women out and about in the streets in public.
Wait a minute. But their hair is at least covered, right?
Their hair is uncovered.
Pardon me, ma'am. I didn't mean to. Ma'am, I'm sorry.
Now, either Alexandria is home to a very large population of prostitutes, or things are very different here.
Right.
Very different indeed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hmm.
So you find your way down the canopic way.
I apologize to every woman I pass. Yeah. Awkward with the ladies. We're sticking with it.
Yep. So you find your way down the canopic way, which is like the main big boulevard.
Yep.
A wide, straight thoroughfare, which causes you to squint against the bright light, even in the early morning, because the canopic way is paved with white marble, which famously reflects light such that no visitor is said to walk it without a veil to protect their eyes.
Ooh.
And also green awnings are spread on the walls to temper the brightness. And even at night, enough moonlight reflects that a weaver is able to thread his needle without the use of a lamp.
That's impressive.
Now, I don't believe that for a second. That all sounds like hyperbole to me. But suffice to say, it's probably brighter than usual.
I mean, I'm also picturing that if they did this, it was like two blocks of the street. You know, it's like they're not covering half the city with white marble.
Well, I don't care if it's all frickin' marble 100% of the way around you. I don't think it's going to be that bright.
But... Oh, I could picture it being. I mean, not like, you know, I wouldn't probably be able to read a book by it. But like, in order to walk around without a lantern or whatever, I could picture that.
Yeah,
you know, not on a new moon, I guess, but like when there's moonlight.
Yeah.
Yeah.
However, the beauty of the canopic way is marred by rubble, damage from a recent civil war here in Egypt, which has severely weakened the Ptolemaic state. And the local Alexandrians are working harder than ever to recover from that. Now, rising above the city on a rocky outcropping, artificially enlarged by earthen construction, is the Serapeum.
Great.
That we talked about, the temple of the god Serapis, that has the daughter library, right?
Mm-hmm.
And odd people are these Alexandrians who boldly tinker with their gods as readily as that earthen outcropping, right?
right.
Somewhere here also is the tomb of Alexander the Great himself, preserved within a coffin made of crystal.
Wow.
Yeah, so you can actually see into it, I imagine.
Okay.
And yeah, like see,
so they must
like,
have used the finest in Egyptian preservation technology,
probably,
which was good, you know.
This coffin, believe it or not, was actually hijacked by the first Ptolemy and brought here to win prestige for his new kingdom.
Wait, from where?
It was on its way to Macedonia.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And they just would like stick him up. they grabbed it and they're like, "This is going to Alexandria now."
I mean, that makes a lot of sense, you know? Yeah. Like, that kind of makes you the real Alexandrian
Empire. It was a prestige move.
Yeah.
But all of that is just distractions. Your real goal here is the Musaeon, the Temple of the Muses, which houses the Great Library of Alexandria. This is the research institution which attracts minds from all over the world, like yourselves, to conduct research here, amidst the shelves upon shelves of scrolls.
Of stolen scrolls.
Some of them stolen. 400,000 scrolls with multiple works.
That's maybe more than the population of the city.
That's
amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. More scrolls than people in Alexandria.
They could give out one scroll to every citizen and still have extra scrolls.
But get this, we're just getting started. So that's 400,000 scrolls with multiple works on them.
Oh.
And then there's another 90,000 with single works on them.
Wow, okay.
And then there are still more in the daughter library, which has another 42,000.
Okay. And so were the ones in the Daughter Library, like, all ones that were copies of things they had in the main library, or how was it divided out?
I don't know.
Or they just put, like, the mystery and romance genres in that library?
I don't know. Right. I imagine that they were the additional copies they collected,
right.
But I don't know.
Sure.
I do know that the Daughter Library in the Serapeum was open to the public.
Oh, wow.
Whereas the Muzayan was not.
That makes me think it was probably copies then, like extra manuscripts.
Yeah. As we said, the Muzayan is less like a library and more like a think tank. And you could also make a contrast between, you know, it's less like a university where you go to classes and more like a Google campus, like a think tank.
Mm.
Where you've got all these people just working together.
Yep, right.
Yeah. You did hold classes every once in a while, but only infrequently.
Yeah. And I would also imagine that most of the scholars working there had... Okay, like, did they each kind of have their own projects they were working on? Or they all have some duties, like you have to scribe so many things a year, or...
That part I don't know.
Sure, yeah.
But I'm sure they for sure all ended up following their own different intellectual interests.
Right.
Because you see that in the works they created.
Yeah.
Everybody was famous for something different.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know what their actual duties were, other than every once in a while they had to give a class.
Do we have a sense of whether the state also assigned projects they wanted people to work on?
Only by inference.
Right.
Like, for example, Euclid was working on optics about the same time the Great Lighthouse went up.
Yeah. So it could have been they needed it for the lighthouse, or it could have been he came up with it and they're like, here's an application.
It's possible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do we have any sense of how many scholars there were in the library?
Yes. Roughly 30 to 50.
I have the sense it might be a very small number. Okay, yeah. That makes sense. Because if everybody's pursuing kind of their own projects, I would have a hard time believing it was like, you know, they were supporting 1,000 scholars or something. Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, very good. So it's not difficult to find the Muzayan. Locals are able to give you precise directions because it's a grid,
mm-hmm.
right? So they're like 3 blocks this way, 4 blocks that. You're nice. Like, wait, not
I'm
past
like, what's
the
block?
Yeah, then they're like, oh. They have to explain it to you.
Noobs.
But eventually you catch on, and then finally you arrive at the Muzayan. On the outskirts of it are the buildings, which appear to be classrooms, although you see no students. As you know, classes didn't happen all that often.
Hmm.
Greek columns soar, and you walk a path through gardens with all manner of odd species of birds and critters. And this is a testament to Ptolemy II's interest in zoology, you've heard.
Hmm.
He was really interested in that, and so he sponsored this whole garden, maybe even a zoo in it.
Yeah.
You pass numerous statues of the Muses, because as we said, this is the Temple of the Muses.
I love it.
Further in is a large dining hall with a domed roof where two scholars, a man and a woman, appear to be taking a late breakfast together and having a heated debate. Tell me, says the man, how is it different than what the priests do when they remove the internal organs from mummification?
Mm.
People won't stand for it, Hegetor, says the woman. It's illegal. But it's necessary, says Hegetor. A generation ago, when Herophilus and Erisistratus opened up the body to look inside, we learned more about the human anatomy than all previous eras combined. Think of the medical advances we could make. Suddenly, the scholars become aware of your presence. Hegetor then excuses himself and walks off, but the woman turns and looks you straight in the eye. Hegetor, by the way, his date is uncertain, but no later than 1st century BCE, so I'm putting him here.
Sure.
Just nice. To be historically honest. He's one of the last Herophilians, which was the followers of physician Herophilus. He was one of the last ones to argue that anatomy is vital.
Right.
Yeah.
And therefore the cutting open and dissecting of people.
Exactly. Yeah. So the woman scholar turns to you and she says, sorry, the Great Library is not open to the public. You want the Daughter Library in the Serapeum.
I'll say, actually,
you're Pergamese, ma'am, it's okay.
Is her hair covered?
No.
I'm like, oh, actually, ma'am, I'm sorry, I kind of look away. And I'm like, I'm Piro, I'm the new scholar, I was sent from Pergamum.
Great. By the way, I'll give you a description of her.
Great.
I'm making up the description here, but she's a real person.
Cool.
Again, just to be historically honest.
Sure, yeah.
Her skin is dusky like the desert, but her hair, uncovered, is reddish blonde.
Hmm.
Her eyes are lined with kohl in the Egyptian style, but her irises are blue. She wears a simple white chiton.
Okay.
So you just said that you're the scholar from Pergamum, right?
Yes, as awkwardly as possible.
Yep. Okay, so she says, yes, I think Eratosthenes said that you would be coming in on one of the boats. By the way, what are you staring at? Yes, I get it. I'm Greek and Egyptian. I'm a woman and a scholar. What does it matter? Why are you not looking at me?
Oh, no, I just didn't want to, you know, you're, I don't know how to say this. Your hair is showing.
My hair? Yes. What about it?
I'm, like, probably putting a binder in front of, like, my... a scroll.
A fortune right there.
Yeah, right, right.
She's like, ah, Greeks. You have much to learn. This is Alexandria. It's a new world here. And you have a lot to learn. I will teach you. She introduces herself as Hestiaia of Alexandria.
Okay.
She's a real person from the pre-2nd century BCE, so somewhere in this area.
Yep.
And she has some pretty awesome creds to her name.
Okay.
Your character will find out about this, so I'm just going to tell you, right?
Great.
She is working on applying geography to literary studies of Homer's Iliad. That's what she's doing here.
Okay.
So her thesis dissects the war against Troy as depicted by Homer, who says that the battle took place on the plain between the city and the sea. But, she reasons, if you visit the current city of Troy, which apparently must have been still around at the time, the only such plain consists of alluvial deposits that are known to have been carried there by the rivers much more recently than that.
Wow.
Apparently. Okay. That's all I don't know how that's geologically possible, but that's what it says.
Oh, yeah. In her thesis. There's centuries of time difference, right? So... Yeah. Yeah, they could build up some deposits.
Possible. The point is, she argues that either the present city is not the city of Troy.
Which is likely.
Or the war must have occurred elsewhere. Hmm. In which case, Homer cannot be taken as a truthful teller of fact.
Whoa! And that's the moment she just rips off her veil.
So pretty badass, right?
Yeah, yeah. Wow.
Yeah. I got all that from Lefkowitz and Fant is the reference that you can look up.
Nice.
Everybody, if anybody doubts that a game could be historical, go look at our references on our episode post. We've got like, it's like a mile long.
And her name is
Hestiaia.
Hestiaia.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. Ah, yes, that's right. So you are the bright young Pergamese genius, aren't you? Yes. Well, I suppose you're used to being the big fish in a small pond, eh? Well, let me tell you, Alexandria is a very big pond. We're all geniuses here, you know.
We don't have a lot of fish in Berkham. I mean, there's fish. I mean, we have fish. It's just, we're not fish.
So you want to study under Beta, eh?
Under Beta.
Yes. So Beta, that's what we call him here. Beta, like B, the second letter of the Greek alphabet, because he's the second best at everything. That's why we call him Beta.
Are you referring to Eratosthenes?
Exactly.
Why is he the second best?
He's the second best at everything. He's maybe not the greatest mind that ever happened in math, but he's so good at so many different things that we reverentially nickname him Beta.
Does he like being called that?
He doesn't mind it.
Okay. So it was a real thing. That was a real nickname.
That was a real thing. That was his nickname.
Wow. I'll say, yes, I'd be very excited to work. I mean, I'm sure all the scholars are, but I mean, yeah, I'd be very excited to work with Beta.
Well, Eratosthenes is a very busy man, however. So, you know, were it not for the letter from your dear Prince Eumenes, he might not see you at all, but as it stands, he will work with you. If you prove yourself worthy, that is.
Sure,
He has instructed me to set before you 3 challenges. You can complete them in any order you like, and you can take as long as you like, availing yourself of the library's resources. Of course, I have removed the books that contain the solutions, but everything else you will need is there. You will report only to me, and if you do well, you'll have your heart's desire. But should you fail at any of these challenges, well, So much for genius, eh?
Sure. Where is the office where I request back my book that was taken?
I can pull some strings.
Oh, that's really kind of you.
We'll get you your copy. So, okay. Andre, how these challenges will work.
Great.
Okay, these are going to be puzzles of science and engineering, and every one of them is a real problem that was solved in the 3rd century BCE by Hellenistic thinkers.
Okay, great. Right? Yeah.
So even in your character's world and time period, they're solved by now, but she's removed the evidence of, you know, where you can find the answers.
Sure,
and
yeah.
You don't know quite this depth of knowledge
sure,
yet,
yeah.
Right? So you're going to have to study your ass off, mm-hmm. basically. And game mechanically, how this is going to work is I'm going to give you all of the facts, like all the pieces, basically, that you need in order to solve the puzzle.
Okay.
And it'll just be up to you to basically put them together creatively and see if you can do it.
Nice.
Now, I'm not a genius. You're not a genius. So basically, I'm giving you everything that you need.
But I think we're both betas, at least.
We're betas, at least. I might be a delta. You could be a beta. But still, if you still can't figure it out and you get stuck, there are things you can do.
Okay.
So you can have your character do things like maybe like try to
charm Hestiaia. That'll
charm
work.
Charm Hestiaia. You could. You could try to like steal some notes of some other scholars or something.
Right.
Or in the meantime, you could even like skulk around the library and try to find your way into Eratosthenes' office and try to maybe steal the floating statue plans.
Right.
All that stuff is on the table. And if you do anything that, you know, is relevant to your problems you're working on, I'll give you a hint. I'll just hand it over to you.
Cool.
Okay. And then after all of that, if you still can't solve a puzzle, you can just do a straight up rock, paper, raven.
Oh, right. Okay.
And we'll just say that your genius figured it out.
So if I can come up with a solution that seems feasible on my own,
you just
then we don't even
out.
Need the rock, paper,
exactly.
raven. I gotcha. Okay. Yeah. Great.
Okay.
That's perfect.
All right. So Hestiaia gives you your 3 challenges.
Great.
And we're going to view this as like, these are the 3 big projects that you're working on over the course of like a year.
Yeah, that would make sense.
And you're studying other stuff too. You study all different subjects.
Hmm.
People back then were Renaissance men.
Yeah,
you know, they studied everything. But these are the 3 big things that she has you work on. Okay. And you can choose to do them in any order. So here are your choices. Number 1, invent a water lifter powered by an ox.
Hmm. Okay.
Number 2, invent the world's most accurate water clock.
Oof. Okay.
Number 3, find the circumference of the earth.
Wow.
So, which one do you want to tackle first?
Well, since I've been told I'm just a small fish, I think I should start with just getting some water uphill.
Okay, so the water lifter powered by an ox?
Yes.
Okay, very good. So you set to work on that. And like I said, you know, this is like a months-long project,
mm-hmm.
right? So I'm going to say a little bit about your experience in the library, and then we'll go to that. Okay?
Great, yeah.
So you commence your research. The library is massive, composed of many wings and porticos lined with shelves called teke, meaning box, chest, sword sheath, or tomb. Those are all the meanings
of the stuff that stuff goes in.
Exactly. The teke are arranged along covered walkways, and there are separate niches devoted to different classes of authors and categories of learning.
What do you mean by covered walkways? Is this an open-air structure?
I don't know either, but that is how my source described it.
Okay.
If anybody wants to check it out, it's Moisov is the author's name, and the book is called Alexandria Lost.
Hmm.
There are some good descriptions in there.
Great. So techies along.
I don't think it's open air. There's
no
way it could be.
That seems,
right?
Right.
Moisture, just humidity getting in there would wreak havoc on papyrus and everything.
Yeah.
So I think it just means hallways that in some way represent covered walkways, porticos, things like that.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. They're organized according to the system set up by the first librarian, Zenodotus, alphabetically by the first letter of the author's name. So it's almost like in the library today, like Library of Congress. However, they only used the first letter of the author's name. They didn't go on to alphabetize by the second and the third. So you just had like a big old heap of, these are all the A's.
Yeah.
You know.
So like Aristotle and Aeschylus could be in either order.
Yes, except it was also divided. There was literature.
Oh, great.
Like a section for that.
Mm-hmm.
And prose and poetry was divided.
So wait, does that include a fiction versus nonfiction division?
I'm not certain about that one. Fair enough. There's also some people like on the internet just listen to music videos too.
Yep.
Art also adorns the library, including works like you have never seen before. Some paintings are so realistic that they even put the great Greek sculptors to shame, employing mathematical precision in their lines to create an impression of perspective, and some actual Hellenistic works show evidence of even using vanishing points, which we once thought they didn't get that until the Renaissance.
Right, yeah.
But at least according to Rousseau, there's some that, like, it's like, yeah, they're using that here.
Right.
Other works of art are abstract and seem to tease the mind. In fact, one is a pattern of cubes which seem to jut out at you, so like the corner of the cube is like coming out at you, right? But the longer you look at it, wait a minute. No, the cube, the point is moving away from you.
Yeah. Oh, that's cool.
So they were working with all that kind of like crazy optical illusion shit too, because they were like really interested in like all this stuff.
Right. Oh, that's really fun.
Yeah. But there are things more curious even than that. Mechanical wonders abound in the library here, including a creation of Philo Mechanicus, the author of the book that you got at Rhodes.
Yep.
Now, Philo was the chief source for Hero of Alexandria much later. His work, The Automata, specifically.
Yep.
Not to mention Leonardo da Vinci, much later than that, also read Philo.
Nice.
Okay. So here in the Library of Alexandria, you encounter a mechanical maid. Now, we have the records that he designed this. I don't know if it was actually in the Alexandrian library.
Okay, sure.
But this was a real thing he designed. Here you encounter a mechanical barmaid that serves and mixes wine for you.
Wow.
Yes.
Serves and mixes.
Yep.
Because they would dilute it with some water.
Yes.
So it was like a much more syrupy, thick wine substance. I cannot explain
the mystery of why the Greeks and Romans mixed wine with water.
So my understanding is like wine was a heavier, like thicker liquid as it was brewed back then. And so once you mixed it with water, I think you would get something more like what we would think of as wine now. And also possibly after straining it, depending on how much stuff was in it, like herbs.
That does make sense. I also imagine if you're drinking a lot of it during the day, just as like your main drink, you probably didn't want it to be very alcoholic.
That's a really good point, yeah.
Yeah.
Because it's really just like a Kool-Aid more than getting wasted.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But this mechanical maid mixes the water and the wine for you, and it's actually really simple and brilliant how he did it. So inside the maid, you research into this afterward. You're like, I have to find out how to do this. You know, you look in your copy of Philo Mechanicus.
Once I
you
get find out. A copy of my copy.
Yes.
Yeah, right.
And then you're like, ah, that's how he did it, right? Okay, so inside the maid are two tanks, one with wine, one with water.
Okay.
Okay, and coming out of the bottom of the tanks are two, like, tubes, like straws.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing obstructs the water and the wine from coming out. There's no stopper, there's no spigot, there's nothing on the end, there's no turnoff valve, nothing.
Wow.
It's just open.
Okay.
But there's no way for air to get into the tank. So it holds the liquid in there in the same way that
like
in element.
Yeah,
in elementary school, like you'd suck the milk into the straw, cap it off with your finger, and then lift it up and the milk would stay there.
Yeah.
It's exactly like that.
So by the way, my dream for many years as a kid was that someday when I'm a mega billionaire, which I was sure I would be, I would build like a 50-story tall swimming pool that's that thing where you could the water would hang you know, like at the bottom of a straw, so you could look up at the water, and if you climb a ladder, you could be swimming upside down, right?
And I think that's awesome. Okay.
Only much later did I realize that it probably the surface tension of the water wouldn't hold that quantity of water, and it would just fail. So
maybe someday.
Just kidding. Right? Okay. Yeah.
Someday you might figure it out.
Right.
In any case, how this statue worked is it had these two tanks, right, and these two dispensing straws. Mm-hmm. Let's call them. And when you put your empty cup in the hand of the maid, it had a weight to it. So it caused the arm to depress, to descend. And that caused an air passageway to open up in the wine straw.
Yep.
It's just like taking your finger off of the straw. The milk comes out, so the wine starts to run out into your cup.
Okay.
That makes your cup even heavier, so the arm continues to descend. That cuts off the passageway, so the wine stops. But it opens up another passageway for the water.
Oh,
and the water comes out. And then the water's weight makes it so heavy it goes to its furthest extent.
closes off
and
everything.
It closes off everything, and voila, you've got a perfectly mixed cup of wine.
Two questions.
Yeah.
Number one, on the statue,
yeah,
where is the liquid coming out of? Just spooting out of her wrist? Or is she like holding an urn that it comes out of?
She's probably like holding an urn.
Something
or
kind
something.
Of vessel.
We
yeah.
get this from text. We don't have an image
of it. We don't
have
an image, yeah.
But we'll have
other question,
a reconstruction
though.
Image on the website.
Oh, that's cool. So then the motion, like the weight of the cup weighing it down, mm-hmm. lowers the arm, which opens and closes the first valve, open and closes the second, or not valve, but tube. Then when you take the cup off, the arm must return to its upright position. Wouldn't it dribble out some water and wine in the way because it briefly opens those two tubes?
Good question.
Yeah. She's a sloppy maid.
That's why you're a genius.
I'm a big fish where I come from.
Yep. Okay, so that's pretty cool.
That
right?
is pretty
cool. You can go get wine perfectly mixed anytime from a robot.
Right, yeah.
But perhaps, as marvelous as that is, even more to your appreciation on just a daily basis are the readily available hand pumps of Ctesibius, the father of hydraulics, mm-hmm. which via pistons and simple flap valves makes it very easy to bring water up from pipes and slake your thirst anytime you want with water coming from down below. You just like, just the hunk, hunk, hunk kind of pump, you know?
Right, yeah.
And then there you go. It pours out.
Nice.
Because they had all that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's great.
Now, as for the community of fellow scholars here, as we mentioned, tends to number between 30 and 50 people, although the recent civil war probably scared off some of them.
Right.
So I'm imagining that this Google campus is a little bit like, you know, the off-season. So a lot of the covered walkways and the tomb shelves are, you know, dusty and quiet as a sepulcher as you walk through them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So the challenge that you are researching right now the ox-powered water lifter. Okay. So this is purely an engineering problem.
Right.
You just got to put the right pieces together in the right way and you'll solve it.
Okay.
Here's the challenge. You want to use the power of an ox to lift water out of a pond and into an elevated trough.
Okay.
Okay. Now, you have a wheel that has buckets mounted on the outside circumference of that wheel.
Okay.
So that when part of the wheel is, you know, submerged into the water, you turn it, the buckets scoop up water, they bring it up, and then they naturally, by gravity, turn, dump out their water into the elevated trough, right? The only thing is you need to make that powered by oxen because people are getting sick of swinging it themselves.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Right.
Okay. That's your task. The problem is you can make an ox walk around in a circle, but that is a horizontal circle.
Yeah.
You can make something turn that way.
Right.
With an ox. But what you need is a vertical circle.
Right. Yeah.
Because your wheel has to go down into the water and come back up. So it has to be vertical. So the engineering problem is, how do you link up the ox that can walk in a circle, you know, and you can have them connected to some kind of an axle or something easily, but it's only going to turn them in that one direction, right, horizontally. How do you link that up to a wheel that turns vertically?
Yeah,
okay?
Right.
So you can use any of the technology available during this time period,
sure,
okay?
Yeah.
And as we learned in earlier episodes, they had gears, they had valves, they had ball bearings, they had pistons, they had cams, they had, you know, all of that stuff.
Right, right.
Right. And it really only takes like one or two major pieces. Okay?
Yeah.
Only one in that list, even, I'll say. So you just gotta pick the right piece, put it in the right way.
Yeah.
Okay, listeners, Andre is hard at work and we're gonna fast forward through his thought process. But if you would like to take some time to try to solve this puzzle as well, you can feel free to press pause right now. And in fact, if you would like visuals to help you with this problem, you can go to our episode post. We're gonna have visuals for all of these challenges in the episode post at www.deadideas.net. Okay, let's check in with Andre and see what his solution is.
And the center of the circle that the ox is walking in, the thing that the ox is turning, you have a vertical post.
Yep.
You put a gear on it, which is going to be a horizontal gear, which interfaces with a vertical gear, which is on the axis of the water wheel.
Tell me how they interface.
So when you have a vertical gear and a horizontal gear, if they have the right size teeth, the horizontal movement of one as it catches each tooth causes the other one to move vertically.
Exactly.
So that would be the... I think, the most obvious and simple way to do it.
So Andre solved the puzzle 100%, but he also came up with some other unorthodox solutions in the process. Let's hear about those.
This is not Roman Engineering 101. This is Roman Steampunk. So, or in this case, okay. Oxpunk.
Okay.
So I'm Oxpunk. Just going to talk through a couple other. I mean, I could also picture, I'm a little surprised that we want to do it with the wheel of water urns, lifting the water up.
Okay.
Because it occurs to me that if we just did an Archimedes screw, then that's already something that would need the kind of horizontal circle that the ox is walking in to drive it. Because that's just a vertical pillar that lifts the water up.
If it's going straight vertically.
Yeah. Would be if you built a gigantic hamster wheel for the ox.
Nice.
The only issue there is I'd some kind of piston-based...
Okay.
Like hydraulic system that just basically just pumps a flap valve. So it's like the same thing as like that pump that you just do with your hand, except that up and down motion of the lever is being driven by the ox walking on something that goes up and down. That seems really complicated for this. I'll still write that in the margin, like on a parchet.
Problem
like,
is
the stupid. better way to do this would be blah 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 blah. But if the client insists on using the old water wheel.
Now, I will say, so Andre's ideas were a little outside the box, but how did you do, listener? If you would like to share your ideas with us, you can absolutely post them on Facebook where we are at Dead Ideas Pod. We'd love to hear what you came up with.
So I think I'll definitely make a note of my great ox cog, which is what I'll call the hamster wheel, to put in my first published work, okay. You know, the transit of water. That's kind of what we do in Bergamo. I'm not sure if you know.
Yep.
But anyway, yeah, I think I would go ahead and start engineering out the two-gear system where one the horizontal gear turns the vertical gear, which turns the water wheel.
Excellent. And that is, in fact, exactly how they solved it.
Great.
We find it in later Arabic texts. And in fact, it was used in the Arabic world up until, well, actually, might even be in certain parts of the Arabic world today. It's called a sakia in Arabic. Hmm. And it dates back to this time.
Wow.
Yeah. That's so great. Basically, yeah, you have the teeth of the horizontal gear turned by the ox interface perpendicularly with the teeth of the vertical wheel, which is attached to the thing that has the buckets on it, you know, that's going into the river, and the one turns the other, and voila, you've got it.
And I think we've all almost been killed by one of these. If you've ever played a video game that has like a windmill... area.
Yes. Yeah. We have, at the very least, had our golf ball knocked away.
exactly right.
Now, listeners, if any of this is confusing, remember, you'll see visuals for all of this. Every step of this process, you know, all the problem I'm showing them, everything, all the pieces, you can see it all at the episode post. Just go to our website.
Yeah, but honestly, if you're not a member of the Library of Alexandria, you don't need to understand it. Just do your job. Just... sewing things by the light of the marble or whatever you got to do. Leave it to us geniuses.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So congratulations. Hestia is like, wow, I thought this would have taken you longer. And the, what did you call it? The ox cog?
The great ox cog.
Well, that's not bad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think we can refine that. Maybe turn it into some kind of battle machine.
Yeah. But don't get cocky, kid.
Oh, no. I'm only going to get coggy. Get a hefty eye, coggy! And then I just, like, look away.
You might be making some headway with women. You seem a little bit less awkward. A little. In fact, that gives me an idea for making a meter of awkwardness. So I'll use later for an awkward party.
Given my hair thing, I think the headway is the most awkward part for me.
So, which of the puzzles do you want to... solve next?
She said I can take as much time as I need, right?
Correct.
Because I want to do a little extracurricular.
Right.
Because I'm a tutor. And the people here feel like the library is kind of this vaunted, you know, collection of outsiders that have nothing to do with day-to-day life.
Yep.
And classes are few and probably reserved for the most elite. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to start offering, like, free talk. Like, where I'll start tutoring, like, basic stuff, like, about mathematics and useful things that, like... And I'm especially going to try to get the word out to soldiers and sailors. And I'll start giving like free lectures and they can, you know, come if they want to.
Nice.
Yeah.
Okay. So what I'll say is there are a number of the other scholars here that kind of look down on that.
Yep.
Because you're like teaching the rabble.
Right. Yeah.
So you're kind of like, the jazz musician that does just smooth jazz rather than like true jazz.
Oh, no.
But you really get quite a lot of buy-in from the lower classes, the soldiery, the craftsmen, everybody, everything below the elite, right?
Right, yeah.
Yes, you actually get weekly people that are showing up, you know, to your classes.
Great.
And around the city, like your name, Piero of Pergamum, starts to become mentioned at taverns and whatnot.
Right.
Yeah.
And if women show up for the classes, I will teach them, which seems probably weird to me given my background, but I probably will just do my best to not be awkward. Mm-hmm. So I'm like low grade awkward.
Yeah.
Yeah.
By the way, the whole women thing. Right. This is a combination, of course, of Greek and Egyptian culture that we're having here. Mm-hmm. The Greeks just brought in their, like, total misogyny, of course.
Right.
But the Egyptians, pretty crazy. Their women, they could do a lot. They were very empowered.
Nice.
For example, one of the measures of how empowered women were in ancient cultures is, like, how easily it was to obtain a divorce. You know, Ireland, medieval Ireland, is kind of like a example of a pretty decent situation for women.
Right.
All you had to do is,
relatively
like,
speaking,
you had to say I divorce you like three times or something, I think, and then you're divorced. In Egypt, they didn't even have to do that.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Just like leave?
Yeah, you just leave. Hmm. You don't even have to have a reason. Yeah. It's pretty crazy. Okay, so let's go on to your puzzle. Okay, so the two challenges that you have left.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to make the world's most accurate water clock, or find the
Heracles,
or find the circumference of the Earth.
Yeah, right. So, I think we've already worked with the element of water.
Okay.
I think it's time to move to the element of Earth.
Okay.
So I'm going to work on the circumference of the Earth.
The circumference of the Earth. All right.
Yes.
Okay, so there's your visual, which you're definitely going to need.
Oof. Okay.
All right, I'm going to walk you through it and everything.
Okay. Right? So, ladies and gentlemen, we're looking at a cross-section of the Earth with what I can only call math on it. This is already a problem for real-life Andre. All right, this can be great.
This is going to be a pure geometry
problem. I figured,
Okay? So, this feat was actually accomplished by the head librarian himself, Eratosthenes, Beta.
Okay.
Yep. And if you can reproduce his results, you will certainly have his respect. Now, like I said, I'm going to give you every piece you need of the puzzle straight off the bat. All you have to do is put it all together, and it's going to be hard enough as it is. But remember, you can get hints if you need to. You can do things that will gain you hints.
Okay.
Okay? Don't forget. Mm-hmm. All right. Okay, so here are all the known facts that you have to work with, that you need to solve this puzzle.
Okay.
Here we go. So assume that the Earth is round.
Great.
Okay, we see a round Earth here, right? Yep. We know that by this time, as already mentioned, done deal. Okay? Assume also that the sun's rays striking the Earth are more or less parallel to each other, which is not quite true, but it's close enough at the scale that the Earth is, you know.
Right, yeah.
Okay, so you see that here. These are the sun's rays striking the Earth. Okay, they're parallel.
Yep.
There is a place in southern Egypt called Syene, which is modern Aswan, where the sun is directly overhead at noon on the summer solstice.
Okay.
Which means that it must be exactly on the Tropic of Cancer, because that's the only place on the Earth where you would not get a shadow this way or get a shadow that way, but it would be directly overhead on the summer solstice. The sun is pointing right at that place, like a straight line at it.
Right.
They knew this was the case because at Syene, on that day, at that time, a person could look down into a deep well and their head would block the sun from striking the water at the very, very, very deep bottom of the well. Meaning that the sun was pointing directly down into the well, like straight down into the Earth. And if you put your head there, it blocks it. So that's verification that,
You were saying also they could like just stick a stick in the ground and it wouldn't leave a shadow at that moment, which would also imply it's coming straight down.
Which brings me to the next fact that's relevant.
Okay.
Alexandria is 5,000 stadia north of Syene, and that 5,000
football fields.
that equals 800 kilometers or 497 miles.
Wow, okay.
It's about 500 miles, right? Right. And at noon on the summer solstice in Alexandria, the sun is not directly overhead. Rather, it is slightly at an angle such that a post casts a shadow. And you can measure the angle of that shadow. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So that comes out to be 7 degrees or 1/50th of a circle.
Other stuff I need to know, if anything.
That is all.
Okay.
That's all that you should need to know other than geometry. Okay, listeners, I know this is a real doozy of a problem to do without a visual, but if you would like to try, you should pause now. And remember, of course, you can see the very same visual that Andre is looking at our website, www.deadideas.net. All right, let's check in on Andre. Let's see if he is struggling with this one.
You know this distance. You know this distance. You're able to figure out the angle then, and that's 7 degrees.
Which would imply that the 500-ish miles between these two locations is itself 7 degrees of the Earth. Okay, that was, I see, okay, that was a conclusion I came to that may be useful, I see, okay. So, I think that what I need to do, so the, okay, it's 500 stadia?
5,000 stadia.
Oh, sorry, 5,000. Between the two cities.
Yeah.
And the shadow at the pole of Alexandria implies that Alexandria is 7 degrees around the globe from the well at Syene.
Yep.
So, in other words, 5,000 stadia should be... Okay, wait, so there's 360 degrees in a globe, right?
You're almost there.
I know, wait, okay. 150... Oh, it's that's helpful. You knew I was going to ask that at some point. So it's 1/50th. So, if 7 degrees is basically 1/50th of a circle, then I should be able to multiply 5,000 stadia by 50 and get the approximate circumference of the Earth.
Okay.
So I'm going to do that now, which is basically just going to be like, what is that? Oh, wait, there's like a bunch of zeros here. So 5,000. Let's try. Okay, I got it. 5,000 times 50, right, is basically 25 with 1, 2, 3, 4 zeros after it, which would be 250,000 stadia, or if I remember my conversion, a little less than 25,000 miles.
Looks pretty good.
Okay.
But let's find out. Put your money where your mouth is there, cocky genius.
I'm trying to think if there's another way I can double check this. Something, something, the angle of something. No, that's what I got.
Okay, yeah. Very good. So you go to Hestiaia, you're like, please check my work or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And she looks at it. No expression on her face, but one brow raises. She looks you in the eye, and she's like, you did not do this yourself.
What do you mean?
You got the exact answer? The exact answer?
It's just math.
So, Andre, you cracked it on the head, and you got the exact answer that Eratosthenes got.
But the important victory here is that I'm actually able to make eye contact with her without looking down or watching this time.
Yes.
That's progress.
That is definitely progress.
I hope she likes shy boys.
Yeah. So Eratosthenes relates this method in the second book of his Geography, which, as I said, is now lost, but we know it through Pliny, the Roman writer.
Love that guy.
And using this method, he came within between 2% and 1% of accuracy of the real circumference.
He would have just done the trip east of Alexandria, like I suggested. He could have got it right on the nose. Yeah. Nice job, Eratosthenes. That's why they call you a beta.
You're the alpha now. Got cocky fast.
It depends on how this machine, this water clock goes. Yeah. This is my...
So, there is some debate among scholars today about exactly how long he thought a stadium was, which would have affected how accurate he was. He could have been way off, but if it was what we think it was, then he was within like 1% probably, which is an amazing level of accuracy.
Amazing.
And he did it with a stick and a shadow. Okay. So, in fact, much later in the Renaissance period, Christopher Columbus did study Eratosthenes. But he actually chose to believe that the Earth was much smaller than this, based on a map by Toscanelli.
Right.
And had he believed Eratosthenes, he would have known that the New World could not possibly be the Indies.
Right, because it would be, the Indies would be much farther
much
away.
Much farther away.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right, folks, Andre has just one challenge left. the water clock, and this one has him worried. And we're going to let him sweat for a while because it's time to bring this episode to a close. We'll be back next time with the dramatic conclusion of Pyrrho of Pergamum's adventure in the Great Library of Alexandria, and then we'll hear the history of how Hellenistic learning went extinct. After taking a nosedive with the Roman conquest, it went through a bottleneck during the Middle Ages, and it came out looking very different by its rediscovery in the Renaissance. All that and more on next time's episode. Thanks to Andre for being on the show once again. Folks, if you like what we're doing here, remember to support the show, which also supports the development of our new show on the history of sex. $5 a month gets you a hand-drawn portrait of the time period and culture of your choosing. I'll draw you as a mechanical automaton barmaid mixing wine or whatever you want. I'll make you look awesome, I promise. Just support the show at www.patreon.com/deadideaspod. All right, folks, I'll see you next time. I'm BT Newberg, and this is, well, you know what show this is. I have to be very careful about Avery's gaze right now because I'm recording this part later and I have to go to work in an hour, so you'll forgive me. I'm BT Newberg, and I will see you next time.